Welcome to the Collection on Audio Boom. On this week's show, Andre Minasian from Master Investor.
I don't have a problem. They came and said, you know, we would like to see what you've done with your phone and what information is out there or whatever. But the thing is, do you trust your government?
Is that a rhetorical question?
De Havilland's Mike Indian.
His reputation as the sort of master of all he surveys has taken a bit of a dent recently. George Osborne is still, though, the man that most people believe could succeed David Cameron in Downing Street towards the end of this parliament.
And Alexandra Russell Oliver from Caxton FX.
I think right now the significant portion of sterling weakness that we've been seeing is largely due to the Brexit concerns.
I'm Zach Meir. The battle for Great Britain's interests continued in Brussels this week, with David Cameron braving the warning of European Council President Donald Tusk that there is no guarantee of a deal, something which is not too surprising given that we do not really know what our Prime Minister is actually trying to achieve. A good start would be for the Union Jack not to be flying upside down outside the summit venue. But just in case David Cameron does come back empty-handed, we had the intervention of Lord Lawson, Chancellor under Mrs. Thatcher, who shadowed the Deutschmark as a prelude to joining the exchange rate mechanism. That was the ancestor of the euro. The result of this was the collapse of the pound in 1992 and the Bank of England losing hundreds of millions of pounds. Lawson has just assured us that Britain outside the EU would stand as a free and prosperous nation, rather more prosperous than the boom bust he created than the 1980s, when he was clearly in favour of the single currency of the EU. Meanwhile, the housing market momentum keeps on trucking, with the UK market set to have 1 in 20 houses worth £1 million by 2030. Of course, rather than grovelling to Brussels, it could very well be the case that just continuing to let 300,000 migrants in a year from within the EU would be the best way of underpinning the real estate inflation and win the referendum for stay. Elsewhere, the supposed driver for Scottish prosperity, North Sea oil, is now in crisis mode, so it really was fortunate that Scots followed the media line and stayed in the UK after all. North Sea veteran Al G. Hall has urged Chancellor George Osborne to take action on reducing the tax burden for operators. Finally, there was better news for fans of stocks, where the FTSE 100 regained the 6,000 level. This was off the back of such fine upstanding companies such as Glencore and Anglo American, entities that just a few days ago were regarded as pariahs. Well, that's the stock market for you. Right, busy week, I suppose, as far as both the EU considerations and the financial markets. But a situation which probably combines both of them is we are warned that the UK is on the brink of collapse in the North Sea. Al G. Clough, who is a veteran of the North Sea exploration and that industry, has called on Chancellor George Osborne to step in with March budget concessions, which presumably means reducing taxes, which is not something that Mr. Osborne normally likes doing. Mike, what do you think of the North Sea? Should we just sort of forget about it now? Has it had its day?
Well, it's a vital sector for the northeast of Scotland, and this is an area where the Scottish Nationalists have traditionally have their strongest power base. And of course, we've got the elections taking place for Holyrood in a couple of months' time. The Chancellor's already made some concessions already to the North Sea. The SNP pushed on this heavily last year, but clearly the sector's still struggling as the global oil price continues to fall, and they need further help. There are such things as exploratory tax credits. They're wanting the government to go further on. But however, the final decision is going to rest with the UK government, and Mr. Osborne, as you say there, Zach, may not be willing to go any further than he already has.
Yeah, but isn't this situation, I mean, it's a dead duck. I mean, it probably needs $60-$70 a barrel to keep itself afloat. You know, oil is at 35 or 30, it depends on which day you're looking at it, so well below what is viable. The more the money is put into it at the moment, the more there'll be losses. Isn't it better just... it seems to me that it's actually just a patriotic entity rather than something which actually might be an economic production area at the moment.
Well, I was up in Aberdeen for the SNP conference last year and chatting to the locals there. They were confident the price will rebound, but they need the short-term investment, they were saying, in order to maintain the technical skills and the pipeline so the sector can be profitable. And also don't forget that there's been a real hub that's grown up here. The UK is a world leader in this area in terms of skills, and these can be exported abroad as well. So we're not just talking about oil exploration, we're talking about a whole set of skills, livelihoods and jobs that potentially has both sort of real-world implications in terms of what people could lose their jobs over, and also economic benefits too in terms of these things, even if the oil fields dry up, that could be exported to countries where there are still undeveloped resources.
I think the expertise can move around, and you know, the people who worked in that industry in Aberdeen, for instance, can go to Malaysia or China or wherever, or Russia, and work there. But isn't it still the case that the S&P, were touting the North Sea as being their biggest reason for leaving the UK? They ended up with a total pie in the face. They were saved from the Scottish voters leaving as well. Otherwise, they'd be totally bust by now. So them backing the North Sea is not great, is it?
Well, it depends on what you mean. The Conservatives are very fond of reminding Nicola Sturgeon and her government of the so-called black hole in the financial projections. But, of course, Scotland isn't going to leave the UK anytime soon, or it may do. I mean, if the EU referendum goes south, then Scotland could hold a second referendum. Public opinion has moved significantly here. Now, I think you're right, Zach, in identifying there's probably more of a political than an economic concern here, but I still don't think that's any reason for the UK government to give up on the sector. It would be toxic for the Chancellor to not announce further concessions, I feel, in his budget. However, he has to think very carefully how he can spin this so it can look as a victory for him and not simply make it a concession to the nationalist government up in Edinburgh.
And he's so good at spinning, isn't he? He's done so well with the Google tax. What else has he got wrong recently? I'm trying to remember. Not a great track record in the recent past.
His reputation as the sort of master of all he surveys has taken a bit of a dent recently. George Osborne is still, though, the man that most people believe could succeed David Cameron in Downing Street towards the end of this parliament. He's amassed a vast amount of power down here in Whitehall. He has a good chunk of special advisers that could cost the taxpayer up to £700,000 a year. He's still very much a big player in the government here, so he's still one to watch, but his judgment over things like the Google tax issues as well has taken a bit of a dent.
Well, he's got that Antonio Banderas hairstyle, which is, I think, much better than Boris Johnson's anyway. That's a definite, isn't it?
Boris has the ruffled man of the people look, though, as only one can get from removing a woolen hat after going inside.
Right, I don't actually want to think about Boris Johnson too much. Andre Minasian, the situation here with the North Sea, just a general question to you. Is it ever worth trying to, you know, the government's trying to bail out lame ducks, dead ducks, trying to buck the market?
I think the oil price is going to stay low for a long time to come. And the recent increase is no indication of that, you know, the downside is over and, you know, we are going higher and higher to $50, $60, $100. I think it might even go back down again. I think one has to look at the macro game plan, and I think the macro game plan itself is to concentrate the oil producers into a few large companies. And I think a lot of small producers or producers who can't keep up with the pace will disappear. And I think that is the real goal. So if they're going to support such production, then they have to support it for a very long time to come.
Well, I don't want them to support it, to bail out the North Sea. I think it'd be a waste of my hard-earned tax-paid money. So would anybody else agree with that?
I think I concur with you on that, just simply because I think they will have to support it for a very long time to come, and I can't see why.
Right. Alexandra, I'm just looking at your Caxton FX blog today. You're talking about oil prices rallying after Iran indicated its support for a tentative production freeze. Unfortunately, Iran, about, I think, 2-3 weeks ago, it was only just able to start producing oil again after the sanctions were lifted. The whole deal, if there is a deal, seems to be just totally up in the air. I mean, the rally in oil, totally bogus.
Well, I think that's one of the big questions, is will we actually see an agreement? Certainly it seems unlikely that we'll see Iran agree to limit production anytime soon, specifically because sanctions were just lifted. And the question then is, what sort of agreement could we see if they don't agree? So certainly we will likely see pressure continue on oil prices.
Because, I mean, what you read is that, you know, there's not even enough oil tankers around the world to store the glut of oil that we have at the moment. So, I mean, literally, even if they stopped producing for 2 months, you know, at zero, we would still have an oil glut.
Exactly. And even if we do see a production freeze at January levels, those were record highs or near record highs. So the oversupply concerns are set to continue. So this current oil price rally that we saw yesterday, again, we can probably see oil prices drop again.
Right. And just getting on to the economic situation at the moment, we've got the pound rallying a bit against the euro with the latest unemployment data, which was a little bit weaker than expected. How much do you think sterling is affected by, you know, the sort of day-to-day economic data, and how much is it affected by the whole Brexit debate at the moment?
I think right now the significant portion of sterling weakness that we've been seeing is largely due to the Brexit concerns. As you said, we did see a little bit of rally with yesterday's unemployment data. The unemployment rate held at 5.1%, which is the lowest since 2005, I believe. So that gave the pound a little bit of a boost. But overall, we do have great uncertainty about the potential outcome of the EU referendum, and that's been one of the big factors.
So we're on hold with the EU at the moment. Just wanted to move on to another sort of political aspect that we've got coming up, which is the London mayoral elections between Zach Goldsmith and Sadiq Khan. And the latest development is that young Zach is going to show us how much money he's been making over the last few years. With his non-dom status, it went away about 6 years ago, but he's still going to show what he's doing now. Isn't this going to be an embarrassing thing for him? Mike?
Zach's background has been one of the biggest weapons the Labour Party have deployed against him over this campaign, Zach. It's probably a little unfair to single him out for this, but it doesn't help to unsubstantiate the charge against him, which is that he essentially lacks any real-world experience. He's essentially just been given the job by his uncle in the magazine, Labour say, and now they're drawing issue to his wealth in this city where there is a widening gap between rich and poor. The real question for this is, I think that it's probably, you know, is the fact he's produced it after being pressured to do so. Sadiq Khan's made his campaign very much about his own background, son of a bus driver from Tooting. I think London is the greatest city in the world. You could make a drinking game out of these wonderful sound bites he keeps coming out with. This is the first mayoral race since the position was created 16 years ago that isn't really about a big personality, but they're trying to fill that void. I would much rather we were talking about the big policy issues here in terms of what London needs in terms of housing particularly. Now, both candidates have, I think, excellent ideas on this issue. Neither of them, I think, really hits the nail on the head. But we keep coming back to these ridiculous personal attacks, which I think are still largely trying to fill the void that's been left in the absence of a Ken or Boris-style figure to fill that personality requirement that people seem to need in their mayor.
Right. Well, there's one point that, I mean, there's been all the talk. I mean, this is just getting back to basics here. It was a question I would love to ask Zach, well, both candidates themselves. Do we actually really need a Lord Mayor of London, or a Lord Mayor of London? Actually, no, don't need that either. But do we need a Mayor of London? We managed to do quite well without one until the 1980s.
Well, this is the direction of travel that the rest of the country's moving in as well. The government's creating metro mayors in every major city region outside of London. Now, Bristol's already got one. Manchester's getting one next year. The devolution deals that George Osborne's pushing through are going to create what IPPR North calls Borises of the North all over the country. So clearly the government thinks that we do. The advantage of a mayor is that many people believe they act as a champion for their city. The London mayor has comparatively limited powers, but they're great force of personality here. We all remember that Boris was effectively an ambassador for this city during the London Olympics. It's one of these things where actually power is moving away from the central government, and it makes sense for it to reside with clearly accountable officials. So local mayors, instead of perhaps more empowered councils, would be easier for people to engage with, I think. London, however, the mayoralty hasn't really addressed, I think, the underlying concerns of the cost of living and the housing crisis that many people still feel living in London. And of course, that's what the campaign ostensibly on paper should really be about. But as I said before, it's becoming about Zach Goldsmith's tax returns, which at the end of the day, whether or not he publishes or not, is not going to affect what sort of Mary makes, in my opinion.
Right. Well, I mean, from my let's say there could be, I wouldn't say my opinion, but there could be a case for saying that so far the mayoral candidates that we've had, or the mayors that we've had Red Ken, who was thorn in the side of Mrs. Thatcher, and you've got Boris Johnson, who is just trying to use the post as a stepping stone to being prime minister. So it's not championing London; he's championing himself, and so is Red Ken. It just becomes an ego fest for these people to be sort of pictured here and pictured there, opening a supermarket and doing this. And the other, even worse than that it's just a continental idea. It's the worst of the continental European mayor of this and mayor of that. I mean, we don't need another layer of cost and a bureaucracy when we've already got Westminster and various other local councils.
I think the real argument is where decision-making is best made for people. I mean, politics for me is about proximity. Decisions are better made at a local level. That's clearly where the government believes things are going at the moment, where they're trying to push power down. Now, their opponents say they're using this as a cover for spending cuts. Now, I would agree with you there, Zach, that the London mayoralty has thus far been about photo opportunities, bendy buses, you know, rather than about meaningful... Boris Island has been one of the more...
the ego-vanity thing seems to come into it, you know.
It's an interesting platform, but the mayor does have considerable power and influence over certain areas, particularly transport, and he does govern what he claims is the
we have
the best
such
city
a wonderful anybody who's been on the Central Line for more than 5 minutes it's overcrowded, it's overpriced, you've got tube drivers getting 50k a year. The mayor doesn't even have the power to prevent a tube strike. The tube drivers have more power than the mayor. It's useless.
The government's going to try and address this with the trade union bill, but it's still the what London really needs is a mayor who can reasonably stand up to Westminster and make the case for more powers to be made in City Hall, and indeed push those down to the council level as well. There's a real one thing that's always worried me about politics, certainly since the time I've been following it, just about since 2010, is that turnout in elections is lower. It's certainly no more than 2/3 at general elections. It's even lower at local elections. The London mayoralty is lucky if it cracks 40-50%. And yet there are really big issues that we have to discuss. The e-referendum is just one of them. Yet there's increasingly a sense that people don't really care what happens down here in Westminster. It feels distant. It feels remote. Their local MPs aren't those individuals they turn to. And I hope that perhaps if they create these new roles and that people take more of an interest in things that happen in their area, it might somehow instigate some sort of revival, renaissance in political engagement again, but I might be just subject to wishful thinking there.
And we don't have a figure of how much the whole Mayor of London apparatus costs to Londoners, do
they? They have, I think the budget of City Hall is about £15 billion. That's including TfL and all the costs associated with that. So it's a massive amount of money they control here. And there was a commission that came out in the last Parliament which was arguing for retention of certain tax powers that for the Mayor.
So I'd rather that £15 billion went to making more housing in London and the greater London area.
Well, if you listen to Zach Goldsmith, his idea is that he wants to extend the transport network and build more houses along that.
But he doesn't want to have another runway.
He doesn't want to have... Well, not at Heathrow. We're not sure about Gatwick yet. He doesn't want to have another runway at Heathrow.
Well, that sounds a bit like a mixed message there. Right, on to another hot potato, which I think there's nothing hotter probably at the moment than the iPhone and the unblocking of the iPhone belonging to the alleged perpetrator of a shooting in the US over Christmas. Apple are defying the authorities and not allowing the FBI to open this phone. Anybody want to sort of agree with Apple?
Once you break certain barriers, then it extends to a whole lot of other people who are not alleged terrorists. And you lose your freedoms.
But isn't the case that, I mean, the main reason for having a snooper's charter, for instance, is that if you are an innocent person, if you're a law-abiding citizen, you have nothing to worry about. People looking at your internet, your browsing history, your tax returns, your telephone or anything else. It shouldn't be a problem at all.
But I think
it's only the guilty who've got something to hide.
Not really. I think it's just... You know, I mean, how far are we going to let the government interfere in our lives, you know, and know everything? I mean, we don't know. We can't find out as much as we want about the figures who actually control, you know, our systems and people who are in government most of the time. So we are giving them, I think it becomes just an excuse most of the time to extend you know, snooping into everybody's life. And then you may not have things to hide, but then you have things to hide too, which is not necessarily that you're a terrorist, but you want to keep it private. And on that basis, I would support Apple.
Even though, in this case, the phone belongs to somebody who's dead, it makes no difference, shouldn't make any difference to them. This is the San Bernardino case, which I was trying to call up there. This can only really help the victims of this crime.
Again, I'd say I'm sure Apple has a good case. Maybe we don't know all the details, but I think Apple has a good case for defending, the privacy. And I'm always worried when governments are able to go more and more into your lives and it just doesn't stop there, you know.
Yeah, but it's our government. There are representatives. There are friends.
Seriously, Zach.
Why are you laughing at this so serious?
I think Andre raises an interesting point, actually, because I'm looking at the tweet Edward Snowden did here, and he says, the FBI is creating a world where citizens rely on Apple to defend their rights rather than the other way around. So who do we trust more to protect freedom here? Is it a multinational corporation or is it the government?
People, yeah, but governments come and go. Apple is forever.
Given the market share that people have with Apple products, myself included, you'd hope that they would find a way to protect the security and the data. I mean, I was shocked the other day when I turned on my Android phone, sorry Apple, no endorsement here, to find that it produces a map of wherever I go. And of course, but we willingly provide this information. There's a tacit consent implied in this. And I still think, Zach, the fact that we don't have the Snoopers Charter, as it's so-called, the Draft Investigatory Powers Bill, to give it its proper name, in place yet, implies that we're still very wary and coming to terms with the level of data and information that we have to put out there. When it first happened, it was a wonderful explosion, but things like Citizen 4, the WikiLeaks cases, have all shown the dangers of us sharing our information too openly. And I still think the best guardian of privacy is the individual. They need to make sure there needs to be better controls on this. Now, I think Apple's right to be sceptical of this. They are creating what's called a backdoor in security terms as well. I know there's been previous talk here in the UK that WhatsApp, for example, those platforms that use what's called end-to-end encryption, which means messages can't be deciphered, are reluctant to have that included as part of the legislation. But the issue of privacy and security is one that's going to rage on as long as we have digital technology in a world where we're moving ever closer together in terms of connectivity, but also want to ensure that we maintain that core of privacy that's so important to all of us.
But not if we've got people who, if things remain private, are capable of mass murder.
Well, it depends, really. I mean, this is, you know, if this is properly regulated and there's information on this phone that's relevant to the case, then of course the FBI should be able to access it. But of course, it's not just about a single case, is it? You know, there's going to be there'll be another incident that'll come along down the line, because we all have these devices now. This isn't a standalone incident. They can't just destroy it. They'll have to create it again someday. The expertise, once you've done this, you can't undo it. So, as with anything, I wish we'd perhaps had this approach more throughout history, whenever we create something, carefully considering what the implications of it are going to be.
So in this case, you're happy to defend the rights of a dead mass murderer?
I'm happy to take the privacy
of a dead mass murderer.
I'm happy to endorse a sceptical approach to any form of thing that might infringe on privacy versus security, because you've got to have a robust debate about this before any sort of step to take.
What is the use of privacy in this age? I mean, literally, you can't even burp without, you know, a camera listening to it, hearing it, seeing it. I mean, there's literally nothing we do now which is not monitored anyway.
I don't think that means we have to have an open door approach to this sort of thing. Now, you need...
Isn't it better just to get it all out of the way? I mean, it's like in the old days, I think, you know, you're probably too young for all this, but it was always assumed that any telephone conversation you have on a landline, this is like in the 60s, 70s or whatever it was, you never say anything on the phone, because there's always a chance. And if you want to genuinely be private, you don't say anything on the phone because people could be listening. And you just assume that you're always being watched and monitored. And, you know, if you want to speak privately, you do it on a park bench in the middle of St. James's Park, where probably there's another mic under the bench as well.
I mean, for example, now we have Oyster cards, which they can trace where we've been, which station, what time we've been in, out, which bus we've taken, which train we've taken. Then we have our credit cards and
debit cards.
They know what we bought, when we bought it, where we were. They can trace us with our phones. They can know exactly where we are, where we've been. And it's just, there isn't, as you said, there isn't really much left, and people put freely all their information on Facebook, most of it.
In fact, we've gone the other way. This is what you were saying to me the other day. We've gone the other way. You know, even if you want people to know about you and you take a selfie of you on the top of Big Ben, nobody's interested. Even a naked selfie. I do that, nobody's interested. Why?
So maybe we should be just happy that the government wants to know something.
Exactly. This is, somebody loves you out there. Somebody's interested in what you look like. You know, it's gone the other way around. So there's actually so much information, nobody cares about it at all.
All right.
So, Alexandra, on that note of privacy or non-privacy, what's your view?
I would personally probably fall in line with the argument in favour of privacy. I think it's the question. Just going back to your comment about defending the privacy of a murder, it's the same argument that everyone deserves, say, legal representation, even if they've committed a terrible crime. And equally, I think they deserve privacy. It's more the principle than the individual circumstance. At the same time, we do, as we were saying, live in a time when we put so much out there voluntarily. I'm not sure that the cost of putting this additional information out there or sacrificing that bit of privacy isn't worth perhaps being able to track or limit terrorism. In those circumstances, perhaps it's a worthwhile sacrifice.
So you think, but from my point of view, if I take a photo which inadvertently has, you know, a suspect in the background, and it's the only thing that prevents a mass murder, I'd rather that phone was hacked into by GCHQ and they stop that incident happening. It's a very liberal idea. It's a very, very sort of cozy idea to think that we can have privacy in a very harsh age. And there are people actively, you know, just like the other day, there was somebody who sort of pointed a laser to, a flight going into the cockpit of a flight going from London to New York. I mean, what's all that about? You know, there should be a register of laser users. I mean, it should be that down to that much, because they're difficult to, if we knew who bought it. It's just like gun control as well. There should be a register of all these things so that we can find out when something goes wrong or something happens, why or who who's been involved.
I heard that they've actually put a new chip in the new passports that once you enter a country, they can actually locate you. Where your passport is.
Well, it's exactly. It's a bit late for that because they've got all these people going from the UK to Syria. And there's no check on that. There's checks on going around, you know, France and England, et cetera, et cetera. But the crucial thing about knowing how many people who's going to Syria, we don't know about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem. They came and said, you know, we would like to see what you've done with your phone and what information is out there or whatever. But I wouldn't... The thing is, do you trust your government?
Is that a rhetorical question? Well, no, I suppose...
Do you trust your government? Is the government representative of the people? And in my opinion, they aren't.
But we're obviously heading for an age within 10 or 20 years' time where we're all going to be wearing an electronic tag of some kind. Everything we see, there'll be a camera sort of, you know, going to a, sort of a central thing. Everything we're looking at will be...
Microchip and everything else.
So
no cash society.
Exactly, yes.
They can just stop you on your tracks.
It sounds like a really...
Send signals and make you do things, right?
Right. Okay, just... final thing, just to cheer us up. Moody's, which is the credit agency, is saying that the world risks being sucked into a self-fulfilling spiral, presumably a bad spiral. Alexandra, do you think that it's all gloom and doom at the beginning of 2016, or is this just part of the normal volatility that we should expect these days?
I think we've certainly got off to quite a volatile start this year. I wouldn't say it's all doom and gloom. Certainly, we've seen some bright spots. As we spoke about earlier, the UK economy certainly has some strengths, including quite low unemployment. So I think going forward, we'll probably see more volatility, but eventually some light on the horizon.
Andre, this is your special subject?
Hard to tell, really, because the markets are they live within their own matrix, is something you heard me saying before. They live within their own matrix, and it's its own kind of animal. I mean, the market, for example, Dow Jones could easily go to 20,000 this year or down to 12,000. I mean, we have both sides, although I'm now kind of leaning more positively and I'm more bullish. I mean, this comes from someone who predicted the markets correctly since 2008. And I think I was probably the only person who in 2008 predicted that Dow Jones would hit 14,000. 2009, I predicted it would hit, it would go higher to 17,000. But they are playing such a difficult game. As soon as you think you figured out the market, they're switching back really, really severely up and down. And a lot of people are losing money. It's a very, very difficult market to make money. But I would say, I mean, for me, 17,000 Dow Jones is the decider, as Bush used to say, I'm the decider. 17,000 is the decider. If you go higher, 17,400, I would give it 80% chance of hitting 20,000.
Right, so I hope you'll come back and tell us, because we're on the edge of our seat. We need to know where the US market and the other markets are going, given our experience in January and February to date. Mike India, you're more of a political person, but I suppose politics and the financial markets very closely entwined now, with central banks lowering interest rates to negative levels. Are we in a death spiral, or is this the dawn of a new age?
For the first time, probably quite sceptical about the UK economy's prospects for this year. The Chancellor's reaped political capital from the returns from the last few years. We'll have to wait to the budget to find out what the revised growth forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility are going to be. At the moment, things are looking good. Unemployment has continued to fall. But there's still an underlying question, something that's bothered me for the last few years, which is called the productivity puzzle, which is, of course, as a society as a whole, are we less productive? Are more people doing jobs but producing less in the economy as a whole? However, at the moment, the government is reaping benefits from certainly low inflation. Wages are outstripping prices for the first time in quite a long while, so the government can spin that as a pay rise. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see the growth forecast revised down, especially given, because the Chancellor has been putting out signals on global volatility, certainly on the European side and the oil prices as well. It'll be interesting to see what he says when he stands up next month and talks in the budget, but things aren't looking as rosy as they were last year, Zach, I think.
What a shame.
With thanks to Andre Minasian, Mike Indian and Alexandra Russell-Oliver, this has been The Collection.